who is an associate professor at Concordia University in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology, and he has been, among other things, very critical of the UN and of Eurocentric views of the world and so on. Are you there, Max?
Yes, I am, and thanks for having me.
Okay, good. I just got to figure out why your voice is not very loud. Let me see here. The phone's on. Try again.
Can you hear me now?
Sort of, but it's not very loud. I have to say.
I'm actually speaking quite loud on my end.
Okay. Well, let's keep here. Try now.
All right.
Yeah. That's really good. Okay.
Great.
There was something there in the switchboard that I wasn't getting. Okay, good. Well, welcome to the show. Welcome to the 5 o'clock train.
Thanks very much.
It's really a pleasure having you on. I mean, the thing that brought me to you, that brought my attention to you, the thing that got me started doing research on you and your views and your unique course at Concordia University, is this essay I saw, which was very critical of NATO and the UN. It was entitled "Libya: Lather, Rinse, Repeat, Syria," and then the undertitle was "Liberal Imperialism and the Refusal to Learn."
Yes.
I mean, you're vicious when you.
Not as vicious as I could be. The thing is that we're living in a period now where the humanitarian ethic is being used in a way that is only serves to bring it into great disrepute, is going to increasingly lose any kind of credibility that it might have had, and I don't think it had that much to begin with. When it gets used for the sake of geopolitical intervention to expand the power of particular states at the expense of others, and where civilians are used as a fig leaf for imperial interests. And I have been looking at cases in the Middle East and North Africa. I've spent most of my time looking at the war in Libya and the justifications used for that intervention, but also seeing some faint glimmers anyway of the same sort of logic being applied to Syria. Whether that will actually involve outside military intervention, I'm doubtful about it, but some of the, let's put it this way, some of the justifications have already been put in place, and we're getting some calls from some very noteworthy authorities, right up to the UN Secretary General, to figures in the media that call for intervention, and in some cases for outright military intervention. So that's something that I'm very worried about.
Okay. Now, so we're definitely going to talk about that. But I wanted to maybe start back up a little bit and start about your career and what you do at the university. I mean, this one course on political anthropology looks particularly interesting. You have a website entitled www.openanthropology.org.
Yeah.
Could you tell us about those projects? How you got into this? How you became a person that's interested in these issues? And a bit about your career path and how you got into this unique course.
Okay, I'll try to be brief because it's potentially a very, very long answer. Basically, since before I became an undergraduate in university, I was very interested in, you might call it, international relations. At the time, what was really dominant in the news and in the political discussions were various U.S. interventions in Central America, the wars in El Salvador and in Nicaragua, and I spent some time in Nicaragua before I became a university student. When I entered university, I entered interdisciplinary fields of study, specifically focusing on Latin American and Caribbean area studies, and always with this interest in imperialism, in international relations, and so forth. I eventually moved to the Caribbean, where I studied and ended up living and doing research in Trinidad and Tobago for what ended up being a total of 7 years. At one point, I even became, I achieved permanent resident status, which I've since lost, of course. And in Trinidad, I began by studying at the university there in a course in international relations, a graduate level of study. It was later that I switched into anthropology, but I switched into anthropology still with this background interest in imperialism, dependency, international relations, and so forth. So I always had an interest in politics as I entered anthropology. And political anthropology is, how do I put it, an established subfield in anthropology. And I'm responsible for teaching that course at Concordia University. So right, I don't know if this answers your question.
Oh, yeah, that's a very nice introduction. It leads me to this next question. I mean, I have been in El Salvador more recently, but you were there more in the time of the actual civil war, is that right?
No, not in El Salvador. I actually spent time in Guatemala, Nicaragua, and Costa Rica.
Okay, but in war conditions?
In Nicaragua, yeah, it was during the height of the U.S.-sponsored Contra War against the Sandinista government.
Right. So you got to see the very brutal end of the U.S. empire.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a devastated society. I don't know if it's like that now because I haven't been back in recent years, but it was definitely a devastated and inevitably a very militarized society, too, where, you know, everybody was being sort of marshaled and mobilized in this war against forces that were, you know, armed, funded, trained by the United States.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you could be brought into the war on either side, right? They were recruiting for both sides among the peasants, right? Yeah. So how does one go from witnessing that to being an academic where you're reduced to only writing papers about it and teaching courses about it?
Oh, that's a very, a very, very sort of sensitive question. It is very, very difficult. There is a considerable amount of freedom within my department and perhaps in other departments at Concordia. In the sense, to give you an example, typically, especially among U.S. universities, they really privilege publication in the so-called top-notch peer-reviewed journals, the high-impact journals. They have various statistical analyses for the impact of these journals and so on. Our department doesn't make an issue of journal articles or not. You can if you like, and if you don't, you don't. Myself and a lot of my colleagues, we tend to prefer writing books rather than journal articles. We seem to be a lot more comfortable with that format. So there isn't that kind of pressure that you must publish certain kinds of things in certain venues.
Yes, where the editorial boards have a certain leaning.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I'm thankful for that. There is also a university that ambiguously, I have to say, but by being ambiguous, they also allow a certain opening, emphasizes community outreach, knowledge mobilization, you know, using that kind of technocratic language.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is that you're transcending the confines of your immediate academic environment and, you know, communicating with a broader public. And I've been doing that for a very long time. I've been doing that since before I became a professor, when I was still a graduate student, especially using the web. So I've sort of continued along those lines. It's a very critical department. I mean, in theoretical terms, they're great lovers of critical theory, of political engagement on different levels. So I'm not really, how can I put it, I don't really feel like a fish out of water.
Right. Well, let's give our listeners a sense of how critical you can be by looking at this essay that I referred to earlier in the introduction. I mean, You, at one point you say, for example, you'll say something like, the UN Security Council has never acted to end oppression anywhere, and it is a tool of the most oppressive powers on earth, and if they act to end anyone else's oppression, it is only to superimpose their far greater oppression.
Yes.
I mean, you're not kidding around.
Well, unfortunately, they're not either. I mean, you think of the kinds of states that make up the membership of the Security Council, and they all have, to varying degrees, awful human rights records. From the Chinese regime to Russia, one has only, I've never been to Grozny myself, and I don't think I ever will go, but you can look at photographs of the kind of charred remains of that city and the kind of scorched earth policy that Russia pursued there, let alone previously its war in Afghanistan and so on. France, which remains a colonial power, Britain, which continues to intervene in different parts of Africa, let alone with NATO and Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya and so on. And then, of course, is the United States itself, with everything from extrajudicial executions, targeted killings, torture, invasion, occupations. That's the UN Security Council. I mean, to look at that, collection of bodies as being the source of salvation and bringers of democracy and so forth, I mean, it's not really something that I have to defend. I'm asking those who want to make the case that this is a force for good to actually prove it.
And
use evidence to back up their claims, because I don't see it.
Well, how would you characterize this philosophy known as R2P, responsibility to protect? I mean, it's something that the president here at the University of Ottawa, Alan Rock, is a great promoter of. How would you characterize that?
Yeah, that's interesting to know about the University of Ottawa. Here at Concordia University, we also have a fairly prominent project that actually titles itself The Will to Intervene, and it involves people such as Senator Romeo Dallaire. And this is essentially a kind of, not a derivative, I shouldn't say that, but a complement of R2P. It's very much tied to that. R2P is, as a number of critics pointed out, specifically Noam Chomsky, an exceptionally dangerous doctrine. It's dangerous specifically or precisely because of the kind of selectivity involved, that some cases require a rush to war to allegedly protect civilians, and other cases merit no attention whatsoever. And this is something that Chomsky pointed to as a kind of hypocrisy that would be that involves the great powers using the doctrine in a sort of in a manner that satisfies their particular interests. And in fact, that's exactly what has happened. There's been no R2P invoked with the Israeli bombing of Gaza, which targeted and killed, about 1,400 civilians and many other cases. There was no R2P invoked in the case of the Sri Lankan civil war. But you see R2P being invoked with Libya. And at the time that it was invoked, the numbers of protesters killed was somewhere around in the dozens. It certainly had not reached the stage that Egypt had reached, which involved no invocation of R2P. So this is, I actually think, a real step backwards. It's a sort of revival of an old colonial missionary doctrine about going to save the natives from themselves and masking the ulterior motives and interests behind the missionary work.
And doing it using drones from the sky and bombs.
Absolutely.
From airplanes and so on.
Yes.
I mean, how many bombs were dropped on Libya? Close to 8,000, I believe?
No, in terms of actual number of bombs, I believe one count put it at 30,000, but there were, in terms of strike sorties, it was 8,000 strike sorties.
Ah, yes, okay. So 8,000 sorties, wow.
Yeah.
Well, I think it would be a good time to take our first music break. Now, you've recommended some music, and I've selected some of the many that you recommended, and I thought we'd go into, and I'd like you to introduce it, if you could, and it sort of shows your cultural interest, this choice, but this first piece is going to be one of the ones that is a little bit more daring. It's called Anti-Everything, The Opposition.
Yeah.
What is that about?
Well, Anti-Everything is the name of a band in Trinidad and Tobago, which is mostly a kind of punk rock band. It reflects something that in the Trinidadian political scene, and especially the music scene, is kind of rare, which is a sort of anarchist perspective on politics. And what they're protesting, but using words that could just as easily be applied to here in Canada or the United States, other Western so-called democracies. What they're showing is a kind of collapse of established party politics between a reigning governing party and the opposition. There really isn't any difference whatsoever. And there is a play in rhetoric. The policies basically remain the same.
Right.
And that's what I liked about the song.
Where have we seen that, huh? Well, stay with us. We're in conversation with Professor Maximilian Forte from Concordia University for the full hour. We're going to take a music break, and we'll be right back. Stay with us. This is the 5 o'clock train, and we'll be right back.
Together in a speech which you then preach like you care. Education, healthcare, take a long dramatic pause and vaguely criticize the laws that you say would be rejected if you get elected. Never mention strategy to move on from here. The opposition vote for change, but we know better cause they're just a fucking same. They have no new ideas, all the voices are remain. Words are only rhetoric, they're spoken all in vain. And this isn't the fifth. The opposition vote for change, but we know better cause they're just the fucking same. And they have no new ideas, all the voices are remade. Words are only rhetoric, they're spoken all in vain. And they are from the field. Yet, yes, I agree we need to oust this regime, but what we really need to do, dismantle the belief that the natural equilibrium is two parties. Colonial philosophy that only breeds apathy, because no real choice means no real voice.
And I'm voting by race cause that's what they teach me.
So instead of my MP, I'm voting for the party. It's a misinterpretation of our democracy. Opposition love for change, but we know better cause they're just the fucking same. They have no new ideas, all the voices are remain. Words are only rhetoric, they're spoken all in vain. And this isn't the fifth. Opposition love for change, but we know better cause they're just the fucking same. And they have no new ideas, all the voices are remain. Words are only rhetoric, they're spoken all in vain. And they are just the
cause they're just a fucking same. They have no new ideas, all the policies will remain. Their words are only rhetoric, it's only platform rhetoric, it's only platform.
And guys, we all want change, but our problems are deeper than they say. Arbitrary politicians with a cliche catchphrase. Words are only rhetoric, no strategy in place. You repeat your mistakes. Opposition for the change, but we know better cause they're just a fucking same.
I'm Ben, he's Jeff.
And we're here to tell you about an amazing job opportunity.
If you want to make a difference and contribute positively to the world, this is it.
Public Outreach is a place where passionate, creative individuals come together to fundraise and gain support for the world's most influential charities.
Like climate change, human rights violations, natural disasters, and animal welfare.
For more information, visit publicoutreachcareers.com.
Apply today to start tomorrow.
That's publicoutreachcareers.com.
Bridgehead is celebrating a decade of serving great coffee and tea to the Ottawa community. Bridgehead supports small-scale farmers by offering 100% fairly traded and organic coffees and teas. Their commitment to social responsibility means grower families receive more money for their coffee and cooperatives receive more money for special projects chosen by the community. Bridgehead wants to thank you for your support over the past decade and looks forward to serving you a tasty coffee, tea, and freshly baked good at one of their 12 Ottawa locations.
This is the 5 o'clock train. We're on every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. every single Thursday of the year, 89.1 FM. I'm your host, Denis Rancourt, and today we're in conversation with Dr. Maximilian Forte from Concordia University, and we're talking about NATO, the UN, and Eurocentric views about how to run the world, I guess I would say. Welcome back, Max.
Thanks very much.
Libya, I mean, we just mentioned before the music break, there were 35,000 bombs were used on Libya recently. That has to have caused a lot of pain and destruction.
Well, not according to the NATO Secretary General, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, who as recently, I think it was either yesterday or the day before, gave an interview with the Telegraph, if I'm not mistaken, in which he disclaimed any loss of civilian life as a result of NATO's bombings. His assertion was that most likely there were no civilian lives lost as a result of the bombings. And it was an outstanding assertion, especially because in the months previously, prior to this, NATO did admit officially on at least a couple of occasions that its bombs did mistakenly kill civilians, and in some cases they admitted to deliberately targeting civilians, which is what happened when they admitted to targeting Libyan state television. It's a civilian facility, it's staffed by civilians, and it's civilians who were killed. So it was an absolutely kind of outrageous assertion to read, but this is the kind of whitewash that is now being imposed. It's being declared a successful mission, and in very ominous wording, he says, you know, it provided what has happened in Libya, and NATO's work in Libya provides a model for future missions, which,
wow,
as I said, is something that I find absolutely sinister. But this notion that you can drop that amount of explosive tonnage on a country, devastating large areas of urban environment specifically, and claim that, you know, civilians could not have been killed in that is just absolutely fantastic.
And I imagine they would have targeted infrastructure as well.
Absolutely, they targeted
bridges,
infrastructure.
Roads, you name it, right?
Exactly.
So,
I mean, leading up to the takeover of Tripoli by the rebels, Tripoli for weeks was going without fuel, without electricity, constant power outages, and also shortages of water.
This is a capital city.
That's right.
So imagine how pleased we would be in Ottawa, for example, if we had all our infrastructure destroyed and we were deprived of any transportation, bringing in food, water, fuel, and so on for weeks and weeks and weeks because some outside force was going to come and save us from our tyrant or something like that.
Exactly.
How would we take that?
Exactly. And how would we think about our fellow citizens who were calling on this kind of outside intervention that was doing this to our country? What would we think of them? And more importantly, what would we want to do to them? These are things that also have to be considered, but they often are not by the media, certainly not by our political leadership. They tend to treat human beings, as in other countries, as if they are some other kind of creature that can tolerate and is even deserving of an immense amount of pain, a fraction of which we would not put up with ourselves. So the attacks on 9/11, you know, a single day, are treated as the be-all and end-all of world history. The entire planet is to be turned upside down in prosecuting the so-called war on terror for the attacks that occurred on one day. And Libya has been bombed every day for 6 months. So somehow they are supposed to get over this. They're supposed to forget about it and proceed to build a new democracy. I don't know what kind of vision of humanity these people have, but it's not one that I recognize as being in any way humanitarian.
And of course, the way that they're expected to rebuild is with loans from outside private sources and bring in the corporations that will help rebuild and so on.
Absolutely. In fact, as you see this week, and I believe it's all in the course of the same week, both the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have been quick to both recognize the new regime and also to promise their support in rebuilding the country.
Rebuilding the country. I mean, there should be a law against mischaracterizing reality in that way, right?
Yes, that's right.
They're installing themselves as permanent extractors of wealth.
Exactly.
Through interest that is immoral, right?
Yes.
Incredible. Incredible.
Yep. And unfortunately, we play a role in that. I mean, not necessarily you and I specifically, but certainly in our name, our government has acted as one of the intervening parties in Libya. You know, a country that has never attacked us, and up until the other day, our own corporations and politicians and so forth were on excellent terms with the Gaddafi government. Then one day in February, everything changed. It's amazing.
The word whitewash is really important when it comes to the media, isn't it?
I mean,
what you hear in the media are these NATO generals.
Yes.
Where are the journalists on the ground talking to regular people who have suffered this incredible invasion?
That's an excellent question. I mean, there were a few, but you know, they hardly made a dent in terms of the overall mass of media coverage. Those who were embedded with rebel forces in Libya basically kept from view for as long as possible who these rebels were, you know, who they were in political terms, what kinds of groups did they belong to, what were their designs and aspirations and so forth, who were their leaders, for weeks and weeks. I mean, the journalists themselves must have known, but they weren't reporting it. And also what they weren't reporting generally were the kinds of atrocities that the rebels themselves were committing. So that's something important to note as well, I think.
And these, we're talking about embedded mainstream journalists.
That's
now.
Right, yeah. Especially people in
CNN, and so on.
CNN, BBC.
Yeah. Yeah, incredible. So we're going to continue to try. Well, so what's your estimation, or how would you sum up the situation in Libya now?
That's very hard to say, because again, you know, I'm depending, and like everyone else, precisely on one of the problems in the situation, which is the media coverage. So the idea is to look for contradictions in the coverage, look for things that are mentioned in passing but not expanded on, and so forth. I mean, it seems that Libya is heading into protracted conflict. There are certain strongholds that remain loyal to Gaddafi's government, and the rebels are having an impossible time trying to take over those strongholds. Even with intense NATO bombing, on average, NATO every day is flying 40 bombing missions still. So it's hard to know what is happening, what level of support remains for the former regime, what level of support there is for a kind of unified transitional government. There's a lot of rumors about divisions among them. So it could potentially be, and I certainly hope for the sake of Libyans that this is not what happens, but it could potentially be a very disastrous sort of situation like we've seen in Somalia and elsewhere, or turning Libya into an equivalent of what Beirut was in the 1970s. I certainly hope that doesn't happen, but the likelihood is there.
Right. So would you say unambiguously that it would have been much better for NATO not to intervene at all?
I would absolutely say that, and I say that without any kind of attempt at an apology or any such thing. The problem from the perspective of NATO members was not the killing that was occurring in Libya. The problem with from their point of view was who was doing the killing. When it seemed like Gaddafi would be triumphant, there was a problem with the killing that occurred. They needed to turn those tables around. It wasn't about ending killing or about saving civilian lives at any point. It's most likely the case that the conflict in Libya would have ended in March, and that all sorts of people, thousands, who are now dead, would have likely still been living. It wouldn't have been a situation that politically would have been satisfying to many Libyans. But, you know, a revolution doesn't need to happen instantly, immediately. Real revolutions, in fact, take years. Sometimes they take even generations. There are setbacks. There are advances. There are multiple forms of resistance and so forth, and an opportunity to build consensus, to build a broad political movement, which the opposition seemed to lack for a long time and probably still lacks now.
Well, a true revolution would create a nation.
Absolutely.
And that would likely be an independent nation if you weren't immediately intervening.
Exactly.
And I guess Eurocentric forces do not want independent nations.
No. And especially not independent nations that have a wealth of energy resources that are in high demand in the West.
Right.
And that it may not have been in a simplistic sense a war for oil, but the oil certainly does matter. And in fact, the reaction immediately as the rebels took Tripoli was very significant, because immediately the oil companies rushed back in.
Yes.
Immediately. They set up relations with the rebel government. Immediately they talked about getting production underway and so forth. So, I mean, the behavior, the actual practice, the deeds tell you what you need to know.
And do you think it was significant that Gaddafi himself, the man, was an agent of African independence? He was promoting that, independence of their money, independence of being able to control their own resources. He actually tried to catalyze that in Africa. Do you think that played a role in this?
I think so. I mean, there are Libyans who will tell you that, you know, Gaddafi's record is a lot more mixed than that. And it's true. The man does have did have an extremely mixed, often contradictory record. But the fact remains that there were a number of concrete initiatives that he didn't just promise, but that he also undertook in Africa to increase African independence, to lessen their dependency on Western sources, whether it's for telecommunications, aid and investment and development projects and so forth. Which is why there was a considerable amount of support across Africa for Gaddafi, and a continued reluctance even now by the African Union to recognize the new rebel government as a legitimate government. They're still resisting doing that. So, in doing so, and in undertaking those projects, Gaddafi was also challenging Western, but specifically American, designs on the African continent. He was positioning himself as a rival, especially when you think of the militarization of the African continent that is being spearheaded by forces like the U.S. Army's new Africa Command, what we hear of referred to as AFRICOM. And AFRICOM was in charge of the U.S. intervention, the U.S. side of the intervention in Libya. And AFRICOM has long been a sticking point with Gaddafi, resisted its presence in Africa. And, you know, you can read about these things, in fact, in the WikiLeaks cables, his meetings with Condoleezza Rice and so forth. And she herself has been explicit about that, that Gaddafi was extremely suspicious of American motives where AFRICOM was concerned.
Now, why would that be? You have to wonder.
Yeah, exactly. Well, now he realized that those suspicions were justified.
Yes. I want to come back to my question. You when I asked you, you know, why would it have been worse with the NATO intervention compared to if there hadn't been one? And you talked about the motives, you know, being disingenuous, right? Mm-hmm. That's clear. But still, concretely, why is it worse if you have 35,000 bombs and you do something in a flash like that?
Mm-hmm.
What does it do to a people or to situations on the ground? Why is it worse than if you had a homegrown, progressive, revolutionary war that might last several years?
Well, what has happened is, well, first of all, we don't know that there would have been a kind of homegrown revolutionary war and so forth, because it seemed that the opposition itself was very much a kind of regional phenomenon, that it was strong in Benghazi, in eastern Libya, but weak elsewhere. So it's not clear that there would have been, in fact, a sort of grassroots resistance in any kind of coherent, organized, significant manner. But what NATO did was to escalate and to prolong a conflict, to increase the number of civilian casualties, to increase the dependency of Libya now, which is going to have to rebuild in part by using foreign sources. And also, there was a massive refugee crisis that barely got the attention of the Western media, and some human rights organizations did report on it, but that outflow of people and the targeting especially of African migrant workers in Libya, all of that produced, went on at a heightened pace since NATO intervened. So they're preaching success because Gaddafi no longer has the instruments of state power. He doesn't have state television. He doesn't have the same kind of military that he had. He doesn't have his capital in Tripoli. All of that seems to be gone, and NATO is saying this is victory. But for tens of thousands of Libyans, and for an even maybe hundreds of thousands of migrants who were living in Libya and working in Libya, the situation has been an utter disaster.
Right.
And the intervention helped to create that. It helped to increase that. And as I said, it's possible that the conflict, it's most likely that the conflict would have ended back in March, late March, early April, had NATO not intervened. But it would have ended in a way that NATO wasn't prepared to accept.
Right.
It would have ended with Gaddafi remaining in power.
Yes.
Which is why this was really about regime change, not saving lives.
Now, getting back to the social structures, or I want to introduce that. If I'm not mistaken, there was completely free state-funded education for Libyan citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And healthcare as well.
That's right.
Of a very high level, completely free.
That's right. No,
so these are bound to be casualties now, right? Hello?
Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, these are bound to be casualties of this war.
Let me put it this way. I myself am not exactly clear on that, because I've been examining some of the documents produced by the rebel leadership, or by the new government, if you want to put it that way. I don't know if to what extent one can take them at face value. I think it would probably be a mistake to do so. But some of the documents do promise to retain some of those social subsidies, access to health care and education and so forth. It would be very difficult to deny them in a country with such a massive amount of oil wealth in any case. But again, you know, there is a problem here. There is a mixed record when it comes to Gaddafi's government. That's true that for a long time, the kinds of things that you described did take place. But when you read the U.S. Embassy cables that were released by WikiLeaks, it seems that in recent years, Gaddafi himself had agreed to a kind of neoliberal structural adjustment that would have ruptured that contract, that kind of social contract with the Libyan people to a certain extent. And there was a good amount of discontent about that as well. And in fact, some of these individuals who are now top leaders in the new regime achieve their status under Gaddafi as trained privatizers, you might say, people very much attuned to globalization, to global capitalism, to structural adjustment, and so forth. So, as I said, Gaddafi is really hard to pin down. Depending on your point of view, he's either complex or mad.
Well, he would have to be complex for such a long time to survive being invaded and taken down.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I was thinking we'd go into a music break again, and you have suggested Fela Kuti.
Yes.
There's a song called Colonial Mentality.
Yes. For me, it's a beautiful song. I'm a great lover of Fela Kuti's music. But he does a lot in that song. I'm sure that there'll be a kind of language barrier with some of the listeners. But he does a lot in that song to portray the sort of surviving colonial legacy in countries such as Nigeria, even coming down to people's names, the way they eliminated their own African names and replaced them with Western names, and the kind of dependency that continues to result as a result of this outward orientation, as a result of this dependency on Western culture and this kind of mimicry of the West. So I thought it was very powerful for that purpose.
Okay, we'll play that and we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Colo mentality.
If you say you think gonna be a man, you can't be slave man before. They don't release you now, but you never release yourself.
And say you fit in, never release yourself. Colo mentality.
If you say you be colonial man, you don't be slave man before. They don't release you now, but you never release yourself.
If it's so, them they do, them they overdo. All the things in them they do.
It be so.
It be so. Them they do. Them they do. Them they overdo. All the things in them they do.
It be so.
It be so. Them they do. Them they think it's said they better pass them, brother. And it be so.
It be so.
It be so. Them they do. Them they think it's said they better pass them, brother. And it be so.
It be so.
Thing with black no good, the foreign things them they like it, no be so.
It be so.
The thing with black no good, the foreign things them they like it, no be so.
It be so.
Them go turn your condition and close them country away, no be so.
It be so.
Them go turn your condition and close them country away, no be so.
It be so.
Them judge him go cocky weak and jail him brother away, no be so.
It be so.
Them judge him go put weak and jail him brother away, not be so.
It be so.
Them go proud of them name and put them slave name for heading, not be so.
It be so.
Them go proud of them name and put them slave name for heading, not be so.
It be so.
Colo mentality now make you hear me now. It's a ransom in make you hear. It's a Williams in make you hear. It's a Aliyah who make you hear. It's a Mohammed who make you hear. It's a Anglican who make you hear.
bishop in Nigeria. He's a Catholic in Nigeria. He's a Muslim in Nigeria. The Africa we devil make it here. The Africa we devil make it here. Follow mentality here. Follow mentality here. He's a ransom in Nigeria. He's a ransom in Nigeria. The Africa we devil make it here.
The Lieutenant's Pump at 361 Elgin Street has long been a favorite gathering place for many a fine folk in Ottawa. More than a well-stocked watering hole, the Lieutenant's Pump is famous for its weekend brunch, Sunday roast beef dinner, and Wednesday wingnight too. Groups can meet in the back room, two can dine in a cozy nook, singles feel comfortable chatting at the bar. In the best sense of the word, there's something for everyone. When you're thinking about where you'd like to go, try the Lieutenant's Pump, 361 Elgin Street at Frank. If you've ever wanted to study abroad, do an internship, or volunteer abroad, then don't miss the free seminar happening on Thursday, September 29th from 1 to 6 p.m. at the Ottawa Convention Center. Jean-Marc Hachet, the author of The Big Guide to Living and Working Overseas, kicks off a full day of free seminars at noon. Universities from the UK, Australia, the US, and other countries will be exhibiting, as well as a travel pavilion. Register online and attend the fair, and you'll be entered into a grand prize draw, including an 8-week volunteer trip to Africa, a 2-week beaches and reefs Contiki holiday, and a flight on Qantas to Australia. The best part is the admission is totally free. Register to attend this life-changing event on Thursday, September 29th at studyandgoabroad.com.
Hey, we're back. This is the 5 o'clock train, 89.1 FM in Ottawa, the entire Ottawa area, every Thursday from 5 to 6. I'm your host, Denis Rancourt. Today, I'm in conversation with Dr. Professor Maximilian C. Forte, Concordia University in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology. A vicious critic of the world order, I would say. I'm starting to think that now. I would like to ask you about the psychology side of things, because you also try to explain why the elite behave as they do and the kinds of psychological message they like to send our way through the media.
Oh, yes. Well, I think I know what you're referring to, and it's something that I alluded to before, that of course, as an anthropologist, I'm very interested in the kind of quote-unquote anthropology that exists, that is practiced, that is adhered to by all sorts of people, by people who aren't, you know, so-called professional anthropologists. That is their kind of philosophy of the human condition, their kind of vision of what constitutes humanity, what the human being looks like in their minds. And I've been trying to deduce from the kind of statements that come out of Western capitals, that come out from NATO, the kind of media propaganda blitzes that they conduct, the sorts of images that they maintain about us as human beings. And I find it, in some cases, really shocking in terms of the level of not just dehumanization, but degradation, that we're, you know, we are supposed to basically shriek in horror on cue. They are supposed to say, oh my God, these dictators, these evil anti-American dictators are killing their own people. And once we receive that cue, we're supposed to respond instantly without giving much thought and saying, oh my God, this has to stop. We must do something. Why won't somebody do something? You look at activist organizations such as Avaaz, I don't know if that's the right way to pronounce it, A-V-A-A-Z. And immediately, when it came to calling for military intervention in Libya, Avaz launched an online campaign and got upwards of 700,000 signatures in a relatively short space of time. So play this role of kinds of bags of emotion without much of a sort of a internal core, without much of a decision-making ability of our own. On the other hand, they might cast us as consumers, as people who always want the latest thing, who always want the newest thing. We're always hungry. We are these bags of emotion with big, open, gaping mouths that always demand to be fed. When you put this all together, the kind of vision of the human being that they come up with is something ghastly. It sounds like some kind of mutant creature out of a horror film. And when they operate on those sorts of assumptions, and when they work to reinforce these kinds of ideas, again, you know, it puts the lie to any claim about being humanitarian.
Yes, and they also want us to believe, the elite, the powerful elite, want us to believe that they're just the same as us as well. They're also headless. They're just reacting, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, we have, again, we can't stand idly by. I mean, by the way, those were, if I'm not mistaken, those were Obama's own words in his address to the nation this past March 28th, when he said, you know, we can't stand idly by when these atrocities happen. We're Americans, you know, we're different.
Right.
This sort of thing.
They're making that clear. But in your essay that we were referring to earlier, you say at one point in a different context, you say, it can be heard in the words of the Manchester police, quote, "We want to make it absolutely clear there has been no spark that has led to this," end of quote.
That's right. There they're referring to the riots that took place and recently in different cities in the UK. Again, there's this idea that the behavior was irrational, you know, because we're not dealing in their minds. We're not dealing with thinking human beings. We're not dealing with people who deserve to be understood and appreciated as human beings. We're dealing with some kind of mass that operates under some sort of inertia. I don't know what set that mass in motion, according to the Manchester police. Perhaps it was Satan. But this is the kind of social theory that they're advancing. There's no cause. There's no root problem here.
Spontaneous delinquency.
Delinquency.
It's
a moral problem. It's a problem with the rioters. And we've encountered this kind of thinking, you know, all the time. And we've encountered it when it came to 9/11. We didn't do anything. We were the victims. We're blameless. There are no root causes here. The problem here has to do with these people and their religion. But otherwise, you know, there is no history before 9/11.
Right.
You know, there was no world before 9/11. And if there was, we played no role in shaping that kind of world. It's an amazing philosophy. To the extent that these people believe it, they're engaging in extreme self-deception. To the extent that they don't believe it, they're engaging in extremely cynical manipulation. But it's amazing to see how many people actually adhere to these sorts of beliefs.
Yeah. I mean, one American academic spelled it out and said there are historical reasons for 9/11. And that was Ward Churchill, and he was immediately taken out, turfed.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
No, this is something, another part of the contemporary historical period that you and I both are aware of course, as academics, and that's the kind of attempt to regiment, to tame, and to silence critical academic voices. It happens a great deal in the United States. It happens to a certain extent, of course, in Canada as well. I mean, you obviously know of cases such as this, but I mean, even recently, I think in the last few months, I was reading of a master's student's thesis. I think the master's degree was done at the University of Toronto. It was held up for scorn and ridicule in the Ontario Parliament.
Yes, yes. That related to criticism of Israel.
That's right. Yeah. It didn't, you know, uphold the right view of Israel. And I'm thinking, you're lambasting a student in the Parliament because you don't like their point of view, the interpretation that's based on evidence, that's not just a wild sort of accusation. And helping to basically not only demolish this person's reputation, but ruin their chances, you know, for a career and so forth. I mean, it was nasty. Something spectacular.
Yeah, it was. It's just incredible. If you can get a little perspective and realize that this is happening in Canada, you know, it should click in our minds that this is happening in Canada now.
That's right.
You know? But it doesn't. It doesn't. It's like, oh, it's just another, you know, random fact that the media are telling us about. But we have to go very soon. We didn't get to... Do you want to say a few seconds about NGOs?
When it comes to NGOs, I have a lot of students who are interested in doing work with NGOs. A lot of them, and I mean, it's good intentions. It's not like there's something wrong with these students or that they're motivated by some sort of nasty ambitions.
But they just don't know any better, right?
Well, to some extent, you know, the idea is that I want to help people. I mean, I even had a student speaking to me in my office once, and she actually began to cry because of this desire to help people was so overwhelming. And if she felt that, if anything, what we were doing as anthropologists was perhaps holding her back. You know, we were trying to complicate things a bit too much. And my question to her was a very simple one. It wasn't to attack her or criticize her or any such thing. Because I realize this is a warm and caring human being. This isn't someone who deserves to be attacked in any way. But I asked her a simple question. I said, why is it that helping people always seems to resolve to helping those other people over there? And her interest was in going to Haiti.
Right.
Her background, she herself is not Haitian. She's a Francophone Canadian, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
Why do you assume that our society is so perfect, so free of any kind of deep social wounds and so forth, that maybe your interest and energy and concern wouldn't be better used here at home in a society, you know, that you probably better understand?
Yes, where you have, therefore, more agency, more power. You're more integrated into it. You know
That's
how it
right.
operates. Yeah, yeah. We have to go.
Yes.
Do you have 5 seconds? Do you have final words?
Just to say thank you very much for this opportunity. I really appreciate it, really enjoyed it. I've become a regular listener of the radio station, listening to it online. Lots of great programs.
Great.
Especially on Saturdays. You have a lineup of Caribbean programs that is just wonderful. So,
well, that's great. And our listeners appreciate the audience in Montreal. And I'm going to end with a song that you recommended as a transition song. It's by David Rutter, Madman's Rant. And thank you very much for being with us, Max. Bye now.
Thank you very much, Denis.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, so that was it. The hour flew by. Stay tuned for Au Cœur de la Rue and this transition song.
We the people ball, but somebody promising more police.
Vous êtes sur les ondes de CHO 89.1 FM.
Yo, dramatique de Mosaïne, peace, you know, big up à...
Cœur de la rue.
Cœur de la rue, man, ça veut dire les racines de la rue, tu comprends? Quand t'es dans le cœur de la rue, ça veut dire que tu vis la rue. La rue bat avec toi, puis tu bats avec la rue. Tu comprends ce que je veux dire?
Au cœur de la rue, you know what I'm saying? C'est être là, you know what I'm saying? C'est être toujours présent, you know what I'm saying? Dans tous les événements, être là, physiquement, mentalement, spirituellement, puis that's that.
Vous écoutez Au cœur de la rue, 89.1 FM.
Hey, hey, c'est Yopio, la ira tout le monde, Yopio est de retour.
Les rappeurs sont...